From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody in the show business is really, really all right life. He's just crazy.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, director Rennie Harlan hit highs with Die Hard and Cliffhanger, and a big low with Cutthroat Island. He talks about making his latest movie in the Republic of Georgia, and he opens up about the big flop that's haunted him for years. But first, the Hollywood News banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm joined by my banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, Eddie Murphy. Remember Eddie Murphy? Because he is going to be, as you know by now, hosting the Oscars this year.
Wasn't he a movie star back in the 80s?
He was a movie star. You know, I will say, because I think there's been a lot of Eddie bashing, including in your newspaper, finding someone to host the Oscars is not an easy thing. I don't know if everybody understands that. It is a very tough gig, and a lot of people have done it and been mocked and ridiculed, and people don't want to take the chance. They don't even want to present, much less risk yourself hosting this show.
No, I think on the job descriptions of the world, it's about one notch above brokering Middle East peace. It is it is a thankless task. I have to say, you know, given what happened last year, James Franco and Anne Hathaway,
Ooh. It's
hard to imagine doing worse. I kind of understand the pick of Eddie Murphy, but this is a guy who strikes me as having not only contempt for the Academy. Remember when he lost the supporting actor Oscar for Dreamgirls to Alan Arkin and Little Miss Sunshine, he famously left the ceremony in the middle of the Oscars.
And he had really blown it before that by just being ungracious through the entire process when you're supposed to be sucking up and trying to court voters.
In your Find magazine, I saw Brett Ratner quoted as saying he has such admiration and love for the Academy despite his incidents in the past, which to me is like saying Michael Vick really likes dogs except for that little dogfighting episode. I mean, I think his history is in a different direction. I believe he's really going to have to win over the audience. And I also think a lot of his comedy is incredibly hardcore R-rated. So it's an interesting, I won't say inspired, but it's a provocative pick.
Well, and of course, Brett Ratner is producing the show this year and has a film coming out with Eddie Murphy and Ben Stiller. So it's all in the family. And, you know, neither one of them known necessarily for the most vigorous work ethic. So we'll see if they can pull themselves together and surprise everybody or something else at the Oscars this year. Now, in terms of what is nominated, you are back from Telluride. Toronto is well underway. You're not there, obviously, but you have seen a lot of the movies. Are we going to see movies coming out as The King's Speech did last year to sweep the whole thing?
Not sure about that. I think the interesting thing about Telluride is two of the last three Best Picture winners premiered there, King's Speech and Slumdog Millionaire, which is not really their goal, and I don't think it's really their reputation. So Descendants, the George Clooney movie from Alexander Payne, his first film since Sideways, was premiered there, and it's at Toronto as well. I certainly think that's an awards movie. But Telluride has never been a big sales market outside of Steve McQueen's movie Shame. There wasn't a big high-profile title for sale there. Now, Toronto not only has a lot more movies, but it also has a lot more movies for sale, films that are playing in the festival that are looking for a distributor. So a lot of these movies are sight unseen. A lot of the independent companies are going to be up there looking for new product. So I think it remains to be seen how good or commercial those movies really are.
You've seen Shame, which was in Telluride and in Toronto, and I've been reading about it. And I got to tell you, this is apparently a very challenging film about a person with a sex addiction. And, you know, there's all this talk about multiple bidders for this movie. As just reading and not meaning to be like, you know, artistically completely tone deaf or not interested in art, it sounds like the kind of thing that two people will want to see. Am I wrong here?
I don't think so. I mean, you've heard of the NC-17 rating. This movie is NC-40. It is incredibly graphic, not so much in terms of what it shows sexually, in terms of like close-ups, below-the-belt close-ups, but in terms of where this character played by Michael Fassbender goes in his life. And Carey Mulligan plays his sister. It's incredibly raw. I got to say it's pretty kinky, but it's from a filmmaker, Steve McQueen, who's a British artist, not to be confused with the late American actor, who, right, not surprisingly, is not directing movies right now. He made a movie called Hunger, which was critically acclaimed, but only did about $500,000 of box office. So it's the kind of movie critics will like. It's difficult to watch. Some company will buy it and play up the controversy surrounding the rating and the fact that Michael Fassbender is largely naked in the film and try to drum up some interest that way. It's a tough, interesting, provocative movie, and I think one more than a handful of people will be interested in.
And meanwhile, as the film awards season is starting to get underway in earnest, we have the television season for the fall starting. And I can tell you, John, I haven't been to one of the film festivals, but if I went to the events that are on offer next week, every night at least, there is a party to launch a new TV show, there is a party to launch a new TV season, and then, of course, the culmination will be the Emmys next Sunday. So lots of stuff going on in TV. Of course, the 2.5 Men episode, the first episode with Ashton Kutcher, which I would imagine will get a huge number for CBS, whether people stick around after that or not. They'll want to see what happens. X Factor on Fox, you know, with Simon Cowell and Paula Abdul together again. And, you know, he's aiming for a staggeringly high rating. He sort of said it publicly. If it's not a big, huge number, I will be disappointed. I'm kind of thinking maybe he will be. I don't know. There's a lot of singing competitions out there. You know, these retro shows, Playboy on NBC and Pan Am on ABC. So there, you know, much being wagered on a very challenging thing, which is trying to get broadcast television to work.
But the good news, at least, is that ESPN has spent almost $2 billion a year to extend its NFL rights, meaning that your cable bill and your satellite TV bill will soon be going up by an equal measure.
Even though I don't watch that much football, but it's
absolutely... You're still going to pay for it,
Kim. I'm still going to pay, and it's important to note, you know, a live event like football is worth a lot of money because people don't tend to TiVo it and watch it later. Advertisers get their money's worth. Theoretically, nobody fast-forwards through a live event.
Yes, ESPN is paying more than $15 billion for 8 years of NFL, and the annual fee is up 73% more than what it paid previously. So a lot of money on the table, but as a football fan, I can't wait to watch a lot of NFL football on my TiVo.
Okay, John, I am glad to pay the extra fee so that you can watch programming that I don't even want to watch. Thank you, John.
Thank you for your support, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. The new film 5 Days of War depicts a brief and brutal conflict between Russia and the Republic of Georgia that took place in 2008. The movie features a truly unusual cast, including Val Kilmer as a war reporter, Heather Graham as a correspondent who doesn't last beyond the first 5 minutes, and Andy Garcia as the president of Georgia, Mikhail Saakashvili. The movie follows a pair of war reporters as they attempt to bring the fighting to the world's attention.
This is Thomas Anders reporting in Gori, Georgia.
No bike. The networks are all covering the Olympics.
Did you mention a war started here?
The film is the latest twist in the career of Rennie Harlan, the director who became huge in the early 90s with hits including Die Hard 2 with Bruce Willis and Cliffhanger with Sylvester Stallone. But Harlan's career began to run off the rails during the filming of the infamous 1995 flop Cutthroat Island, starring his then-wife Gina Davis. The production was chaotic, Harlan and Davis were accused of diva behavior, and the film was blamed for the bankruptcy of the Carolco production company. Harlan has not hit the big box office highs since, though he's directed such genre movies as a prequel to The Exorcist. 5 Days of War, based on real events with an anti-war message, sent him in a very new and unusual direction. It's fair to say that the film, financed by investors from Georgia, tells the story from a particular point of view, so don't look for a big release if you live in Russia. With a budget of only about $12 million, Harlan didn't have the option of using effects houses to help with battle sequences, but he did have real tanks, fighter jets, and soldiers thanks to the Georgian military. While the Finnish-born Harlan was vaguely familiar with events in Georgia, it's fair to say he hadn't exactly focused on the conflict there until this project happened to come his way.
Less than a year after the actual war took place, a group of Georgians came to Hollywood for the first time in their lives, looking for partners in order to make a movie about this war, because they were so frustrated. They felt like The world didn't hear them. The world didn't know what happened. And they thought, well, cinema, the language of cinema can reach anybody.
Are these Georgian filmmakers, Georgian politicians, Georgian money guys?
Georgian money guys and I think one politician. And so they run into this American producer who is specialized on sort of distributing Eastern Bloc movies and selling them and blah, blah, blah. So
do we know who this person is?
This person's name is George Lascu, and he has a company called Rex Media, very small distribution company. So they get together, and then George happens to have breakfast with my agent and mentions about the project. My agent says, well, I have the perfect guy for you. George says, you know, you're kidding. This is a small budget movie and Renny Harlin will never want to do this and blah, blah, blah. But just prior to this, I have changed agencies because I have this real urge to do actually something that I could believe in, something that it feels a little more real. So it's like perfect timing. And so I meet with the producers. They show me some video and pictures from the war, and I read some stuff on the internet, and I get madly passionate.
Is there Georgia money, government money backing the film?
No government money at all. All independent money. And this might be one of the only movies in history that actually was financed from a gold mine. We actually found a gold mine, literally. There was this one producer whose name is Koba Nakopia, and he owns a gold mine.
Okay.
And so we just told him to dig deeper, and he came up with that with a lot of the money. Then we did a lot of the financing the old-fashioned way, which is foreign pre-sales. Once they got me involved and we got some actors involved, then we were able to sell some foreign territories and get some money like that.
Interesting. I want to talk about the actors in a second, but first I just want to stop and talk about you didn't have government money from the Georgian Republic, but you did have enormous cooperation. I'm just reading something from the press materials here. You had 16 tanks.
80 tanks.
80 tanks. Okay, see, yes. 140,000 rounds of blank ammunition, 300 AK-47 rifles, four jets, the Georgia Air Force's most advanced jet, attack helicopters, military helicopters. How does that work?
It was really an amazing opportunity for a filmmaker. I don't know if since the 50s anybody's had a chance to use that kind of hardware, because as we know nowadays, pretty much everything is done digitally.
I'm sure Jerry Bruckheimer is sort of sick with envy.
But we had scenes where in one scene we had 80 tanks, six fighter jets, eight helicopters, 4,000 soldiers, and full-on battle scenes. And
literally soldiers, not actor soldiers.
No. These were real soldiers. Only problem was that these soldiers had just 1 year prior fought for their lives and for their country against Russians. And now I told half of them to wear Georgian uniforms and half of them had to wear Russian uniforms. But we didn't get anything for free from the government, but we did get a very good rate. But of course, the movie was only possible because of the support from the government. But this was not a government-sanctioned movie. They never saw the script. And we actually had disagreements about several scenes where, for example, toward the end of the movie, there's a scene where a group of Georgian soldiers surrender to the Russians because of reasons that you just have to see the movie to understand.
Right, no spoilers.
But the soldiers refused to do it. And I had to call their commander, and the commander came there, and then finally they did it, and then it just caused a big problem because they said, we would never surrender. We would just die rather than surrender. But I said, dramatically, in the story of the movie, you have to surrender at this point.
So you've got this gigantic operation going on, and the actors are definitely one of the true, I mean, the whole story is a little bit of a curveball, but the actors are amazing. And I almost want to go through, and it's not a spoiler for me to say Heather Graham, she gets bumped off like in the first 5 minutes.
She has to leave the set.
What do you say to her? You say, I want you to, did you shoot this on location, I assume?
Everything was shot in Georgia, mostly in real locations.
How long does it take to get to Georgia?
It's quite complex to get there. And because of the time difference, you cannot get there from Los Angeles in less than 2 full days.
So you say to Heather, I've got this great role for you. It's at least 3 minutes long. And come here and spend this time. You will be spending much more time getting here than you actually will have to be doing anything on the set.
I think that in general, with all the actors, it came down to the material. When I explained to them what we were doing and they read the screenplay, all of them got very passionately involved. And they didn't care about the fact that it takes forever to get there. They didn't care about the fact that we actually, a lot of the shooting time, we stayed in mountain villages where the crew was living and sleeping on a train. And I was living in a farmhouse with the actors where everybody had one bedroom. We shared a bathroom. We shared a kitchen where we cooked our own meals and stuff like that. You don't get Hollywood actors to do that usually.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with director Renny Harlin, whose new film, 5 Days of War, stars Rupert Friend, Val Kilmer, and Andy Garcia. I asked him how he coped with Kilmer, whose reputation as a difficult talent precedes him.
I think Val is one of those guys who is incredibly intelligent, very creative. He expects a collaboration, and he expects also somebody who have a very strong point of view about what they are doing. And he'll test you, and he'll come up with all kinds of ideas and see if you're going to be afraid of him and say, okay, let's do that. Why don't you wear a shower cap in this scene? And once that happens, then he'll just have to take charge because he thinks that you don't know what you're doing.
Now, the biggest curveball for me, of course, is Andy Garcia as the president. I mean, he's Cuban born, and I gather he has a huge physical resemblance. I haven't looked up what the president, say it
Saakashvili.
He looks like him. You were
yes.
in the president's office. I mean, that was a part of the cooperation that he was sitting in the president's chair, literally.
Yeah, it was pretty surreal. We got to know the president very well. And
does he look like Andy Garcia?
Yes. One night I'm out with the president and we're prepping the movie and I ask him, who's your favorite actor? And he says, Andy Garcia. I'm like, that's genius because he looks just like you. And he's very flattered. And I say, well, I think we should have Andy Garcia play you in the movie. And he's like, I can't believe it. That's too great, blah, blah, blah. And so we get in touch with Andy. And I don't know if it's, you know, maybe it has something to do with his Cuban-American roots. But his game immediately.
He's not a big lover of the Russian regime.
Probably not. And
okay.
It was great.
That is definitely a twist.
And you mentioned about the president's office. That was the thing. When I asked the producers, like, where can we shoot these scenes in the president's office, they look at me like I'm crazy. They're like, what do you mean? You said president's office, so why don't we shoot them in the president's office? It's like we are in the White House, in the Oval Office shooting, and there's all the president's papers and stuff is on the desk. And one day we're shooting there and like the red phone rings and we're in the middle of a take and it just grabs the phone, takes the receiver and says, not now, we're shooting, and puts the receiver down.
So you've done a lot of action movies in the past and you had actual stuff in this case, you know, actual military personnel and equipment. Is it the same or different? How does it compare?
I think it's any filmmaker's dream to have all the toys in the world. And it was challenging because controlling a set where 17 different languages are spoken, the crew comes from all over the world, the Georgians have no filmmaking experience whatsoever, the Army people and Air Force people have never even seen a camera, to try to explain to them how we're going to do this and that we can't use real bullets and real explosions and stuff like that. There was just logistics were huge. Just considering that we have 2,000 soldiers in the scene who all have fake bullets. But then to guard all this military equipment and these jets and helicopters and tanks, we have to have real soldiers with real bullets. So, and then we all go to lunch and everybody puts their guns wherever. There's just so many logistical challenges in making
like
sure
a
that
bad
it's
situation.
Yeah, that it's safe. Next to me, I have the commander of the Air Force and the commander of the Land Force, and they have like 3 walkie-talkies in their hands, and I have an army of translators. I'm trying to estimate how long does it take for the tanks to roll over the hill, and when should I cue the helicopters, and when the jets, and when the people, so they don't get run over by the tanks, and all that. So it's a big logistical puzzle, but at the same time, I'm the type of a director who loves that.
Coming up after a short break, director Renny Harlin talks about his infamous flop, Cutthroat Island. You're listening to The Business from KCRW and KCRW.com. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with director Renny Harlin. His latest film is 5 Days of War, about a brief 2008 conflict between Russia and the Republic of Georgia. Harlin made his name on big action movies like Cliffhanger and Die Hard 2. Still, one film has hung over his head for years now, Cutthroat Island, the 1995 pirate movie starring his then-wife, Gina Davis. After that film bombed, it was listed in the Guinness Book of World Records as the biggest box office flop in history. It reportedly cost $98 million and made $10 million. I asked Harlin how Cutthroat Island affected him professionally.
Well, it was a good reminder, I think, in a way that when you start believing in yourself too much and thinking like you're invincible and you're a genius, it's good that somebody kind of brings you down and says, like, okay, you're definitely not genius, and you've had a good run, but you have to, you know, be humble and play by the rules. And I went on after that, to make movies like Deep Blue Sea for Warner Brothers, which made a couple of hundred million in the worldwide box office. So it was definitely, you know, a moment that stopped me. When you're young, I was still in my early 30s, and you're young and you've had a string of big hits, you just feel like that's always going to continue like that. So for me, it's I honestly think that failures teach you more than success.
So at the time, you know, people blamed it for the demise of Carolco, which was the studio. I don't know if that's really fair.
Well, once and for all, if we can discuss it here without, putting blame on anybody, I'd like to remind people that in the span of, let's say, 3 years before Cutthroat Island, Carolco made movies like Total Recall, Basic Instinct, Cliffhanger, all of them making hundreds of millions of dollars. When I started on Cutthroat Island, Carolco was already bankrupt. They had the money, which was about $60 million, earmarked for this movie. The foreign partners had already paid the money, so they had to make the movie. But they knew it was the last movie they were going to make. And who knows why the company went belly up, but the company was in that situation before we shot one frame of Cutthroat Island. For somebody to think that one movie
right.
would bankrupt a company
it's
with
naive,
that kind of success,
of
with Rambos and all these movies, Terminator and so on, it's ridiculous. And what happened with us was that not only Carolco was already bankrupt, which meant that when Cutthroat Island came out, there was no support from Carolco for it because they didn't have any money left. Plus, Cutthroat Island was one and only release left with MGM.
Right.
And to add to that, MGM was being sold.
Right.
So those people selling MGM did not want to spend money in marketing and take away of the assets of the company that were quite low as they were. So it was Christmas time, around 95, I guess. And there we come out with no marketing budget whatsoever. And Christmas time, all the movies
right, huge
have
competition.
Huge campaigns mm-hmm. and so on. So we knew. We knew weeks and weeks. We knew months before the movie was even finished that we didn't have any chance. Yet we went on and we finished the film. We did our best. But that was the situation.
So let me just a couple more questions about that. When you are this guy who's at the top of his powers, you've generated lots and lots, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in box office. You were talking about the arrogance of the time, and you see this happening. What was that like? I mean, were you thinking, I'm getting screwed, or I hate these people, or why am I being? Did I do something in my former life? I mean, what was the time? What was it like at the time?
I'll tell you even another detail that people don't know about. Originally, Michael Douglas was supposed to star in
Cutthroat
Island.
Right, he walked away at a certain point.
And he walked away. And at that point, I was left there with my then wife, Gina Davis,
right.
and myself, and a company that was already belly up.
Right.
We begged to be let go. We begged that we didn't have to make this movie.
Hmm.
And I don't think I've ever said this in any interview. We begged that we would not be put in this position. Gina was scared mindless about headlining this film. We felt that a pirate movie with a female lead was suicidal, but we were contractually obligated. And we were so concerned about the script at that point that I personally spent $1 million of my own money.
Wow.
I hired Mark Norman, who had won an Oscar for writing Shakespeare in Love. So I tried to hire the best writer in the business because, again, Carolco said, we don't have money. We don't care if the script is not good or if it doesn't work anymore because it was written for Michael Douglas and now it's not that story anymore. So I spent $1 million of my own money to hire Mark Norman to write the script. We did the best we could under the circumstances. So was it painful when it all came crashing down? Yes. Did we learn a lot? Yes.
And the press kind of jumped on you and made you out to be big prima donnas, right?
Yes. And it's the funny thing is, I think everybody in Hollywood has ups and downs. It's just the nature of the beast. But it's the funny thing is that Cutthroat Island seems to just follow me.
Right.
I mean, it was over 15 years ago.
I was going to say, do you feel like you've been sort of punished for that thing?
I think it's ridiculous that reviewers bring it up in actual movie reviews still.
Every time.
Don't you have anything else to come up with? That's crazy.
So since then, you've had, you've made some films and it's been difficult in some ways in terms of box office. I don't know. Do you feel that you were connected to the zeitgeist and you're less connected to the zeitgeist or you're choosing differently? What's going on?
No, I think that, there are a lot of factors. Some movies are good, some are less good. Sometimes the timing, the marketing, a lot of things play into this situations, how movies are released and how successful they are. And if it was a science where you know what works, then you would only need about five directors in the whole world and every studio would be making tens of billions every year.
Well, it's funny. I almost feel like we are down to five directors in terms of action films. And you're watching these guys who are now, stars have fallen away as powers in Hollywood. Agents have fallen away to some degree as powers in Hollywood. And the real power resides with a Christopher Nolan or a Michael Bay or a James Cameron. What do you look at? You look at that and think, I'm actually one of you and Hollywood isn't giving me those movies. What do you make of it?
Those are all amazing directors in their own right. But of course, you think that you're one of them and you're capable of similar things. If you're a heart surgeon, I don't think that you wake up one morning and say, I can't do surgery anymore. You still think that you're a heart surgeon. Sometimes you have to reinvent yourself and do a smaller movie or something different and hope that is going to get the attention of those who make the decisions. Because let's face it, more than ever before, Hollywood is sheer business. Whether the movie is good or bad, if it makes money, that filmmaker knows something. He
right.
knows some kind of a magical connection to the audience, and he'll get to make another one. If then that fails, then it's going to be another question whether he's going to have another chance right away. And it's a business. I understand it. And it's like race car drivers. If you keep winning, you get the best cars.
So thank you so much for coming in. This has been great. I really appreciate your candor and your story. Fascinating. Thank you for coming
My
in
pleasure.
And telling us.
Thank you, Kim.
5 Days of War is now playing in Los Angeles, New York, and Washington, D.C. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. We had a big assist this week from Jenny Radelet. To leave a comment, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness, where you can stream or podcast the show. You can listen to us on demand on your iPhone, Android, or BlackBerry with our KCRW apps. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. And be sure to check out our Facebook page, KCRW's The Business. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.